Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds ideas to the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Vigor, a branding and advertising agency focused on the restaurant and hospitality industry, and by Quench, a food and beverage advertising agency that specializes in evolving iconic food and beverage brands. Learn more, visit vigorbranding.com and quenchagency.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
Hi, my name is Michael Pavone, and welcome to Fork Tales. Today, we are joined by Amit Pandey. He's the president, CEO of Westminster Cracker Company, and a longtime food industry leader. Amit has built, fixed, and scaled, I highlight fixed, and scaled multiple food businesses, from leading the turnaround and the eventual sale of Pop Chips to running Harvest Food Group. Today, he's writing the next chapter of Westminster, a cracker company whose roots go back to 1828. Amit, welcome to Fork Tales. It's great to have you on.
Mike, thanks for having me on. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
So, and I, you know, in full disclosure, I know Amit, he and I are informed together, and he's awesome, and I'm really, really, really pleased to have you on here, and I appreciate it. So, you've led a lot of food companies to some big turnarounds and wins. What keeps you interested in this whole industry?
You know, honestly, nobody would have predicted this for me. Growing up, I didn't know anything about food or nutrition. It wasn't something we talked about. My lunch every day was 2 sodas and 2 bags of chips. So I never came at it from like knowing food and better for you. But one of the first conferences, I was running an ice cream company I founded, and a competitor, a direct competitor, didn't have spoons to hand out at the show. Their whole show was over before it started. And I carried over 4 boxes of our own spoons. It was about 6,000 or 7,000 spoons. And then years later, I am trying to install new equipment in a plant. My equipment is delayed 6 months. I have a huge order that's dependent on the equipment. I'm about to miss the launch and basically lose the biggest retailer in the country. Those same guys had a spare, and it's $500,000 piece of equipment. They packed it up and they shipped it to me. Wow. I offered to pay any price for it. They could have extorted me for anything.
Right, right.
And they reminded me that years earlier, I'd given them the spoons and they were paying it back. So really, I gave away 6,000 spoons and got back $500,000 of equipment. That is what this industry is about. And
that's
so
awesome.
I now spend a lot of my time helping people. And when they ask me what they can do to pay it back, I tell them the same thing. Like, where you are now is someone else's dream. Pay it forward. And that's what I love so much about mm-hmm. this industry.
Yeah. And I absolutely love that line, you know, where you're at now is someone else's dream. And that's, hey, look, for any entrepreneur, I think that's it. That's it. Right. And most people that start things, they, you know, they don't know what you're doing. I mean, you know, you have some drive, you have some hunger, you have a passion, but you're not an expert. I don't, you know, anybody says they are is probably not going to last very long. So I love that. I love that line. So, okay, you've worked across frozen desserts, snacks, frozen food, and now crackers. What have you learned that applies to, you know, in each package? Like, what have you learned from all these different various areas of the food business?
Yeah, it's really one thing, and it isn't about the food at all. It's hire the right people, give them the right resources, get the hell out of the way. And that's mm-hmm. really the one thing that's traveled with me across every category. The technical problems are different. I'm not an expert in any of them. The person running the line is the person who's closest to the opportunity, the customer, the vendor. And so the failure mode everywhere is the team. Mm-hmm. And so getting the right folks is really the whole game.
Yeah. And again, very sage advice, because you know, you've done this several times. And I'll say in my own world, you know, starting my own company, I probably was too slow at some of that. Like, in other words, the relationships build and you don't necessarily make the tough decisions, if you will, to get the right team, right? And I always try and remind myself that. It's funny, I always think too, because we've done acquisitions. When you go in to do an acquisition, you're like, oh, well, there's some redundancy there, or that person's better than what we have here. You know, you kind of like, you can, it's a, like a, maybe a game of chess, like make this move. That's all strategic alignment and it works. When you look at your own company, it's like, well, I should have done that. I should have done that. Or if I was on the outside looking in, buying my company, I'd be like, well, right away, I'd probably do this, this, and this. I'm like, well, why don't you do it? And that's, you know, so the right team, I think, is it's easy to say, not so easy to do. And I commend you for that.
It's easier when you're coming in from the outside.
Sure.
You know, you get sort of bring a fresh set of eyes. I think it's much harder. And when I was running my own company, when I was a founder, I was a lot slower to make the necessary changes. But I always think you have to handle people with grace. And just because they're not the right fit for you, your organization at that point in time, it doesn't mean they didn't add a tremendous amount of value along the way. I think we want everyone to be a rock star, right? An A player. And sometimes that place isn't where we are as a company or as an organization.
That's good. That's right. So being so close to the food industry, branding, when you walk into a grocery store, can you still just shop like a normal human being? Or are you like looking constantly, analyzing everything, looking at the back of the label, looking at the product design, the where they're positioned and all that?
Yeah, I really can't walk through a grocery store like a normal person. And I've stopped pretending. I don't really look at the shelf. I look at the date codes on the back of the package. Mm-hmm. The shelf tells you what the category manager bought. The date code tells you what the shopper is actually buying. And if you flip over three packages and they're all 4 months old, I can usually tell you what the brand's year looked like, and even when they don't. Beyond that, when I walk every aisle, I'm reorganizing the shelves. I'm taking pictures of friends' brands and shooting them off to my friends. Or to other executives. And you know who won't walk or go into a grocery store with me?
That was my next question. Go ahead. I knew that.
Never goes shopping with me. A 10-minute milk and eggs run turns into an hour and a half trip every time.
Yeah, I you know, that was going to be my next question, and I knew the answer to it. That's funny. Who's the primary shopper, though? Is she the primary, or are you the primary?
It's both of us. We both take shifts, I think. We both like different things, so we're usually buying, what we each like to make, which is good. I really enjoy cooking. I really think it's important to know where your food's coming from. I even made my kids plant trees and a garden so they could see it doesn't just come from packaging; it comes from the ground.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I can see, like, I guess in my mind, I pictured like your wife doing the heavy lifting as far as the massive of the grocery stores, grocery shopping, and you doing like the milk and eggs, but it's still taking the same amount of time she takes to do like the whole week's order.
She won't come to the store with me. She's like, you go on your own. And my kids are starting to realize that they don't want to be in the grocery store.
Yeah, they don't
store
go either.
It's a problem.
That's awesome. So you stepped into several established brands, and, you know, so rather the spending your career at one company, you've kind of moved around and built and left and sold and do different things. What attracts you to that challenge?
I think my unpopular version of this is I've never been loyal to a logo. I've been loyal to the same problem for 20 years, and it just keeps changing the addresses, right? The convention is that a good career is at one company. It's a long tenure. Mm-hmm. And I just don't buy it. The thing I believe you should be loyal to is the work. And look, I've done all sides of this, right? I've been a founder. I grew it from zero, scaled it, sold it. I sit on boards now. I'm an operator. It's brutally hard. And I have enormous respect for all founders. But also, we've sort of decided as an industry, the founder story is the only interesting one, right? No one writes the profile about the person who's looking for a tired 40-year-old brand that, you know, makes it matter again, makes it relevant, and you save 200 jobs doing it. And for me, that's the work I keep choosing. And really, it's interesting because you inherit real constraints, a real clock. Yeah. You find out very quickly if you were right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And you usually inherit a team that's been told no for so many times, for many years. And watching that flip, that's the best part of the job.
Yeah. And I, look, knowing you personally, and I mean, this is the greatest compliment. You have a very clear path in your mind of what, how things have to be. So I imagine jumping into some of these different companies that are, again, already established, been around for since 18, whatever, the crackers, right? I mean, you're, you know, there's some legacy thinking, there's some legacy people, there's some legacy process, and you're not a legacy type of guy. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. You're in there to fix things, make things better. And you I say this about myself, and I know this about you. Patience is not your virtue, right?
So. It's not.
So I talk a little bit about that, like, you know, kind of how, like that coming into, you know, you have to, you go in with sort of kid gloves because you got to get hired. So you got to sell yourself. But then, you know, obviously people are hiring you because they want change. They're not saying like, let's keep things the same, sit on this nest and don't make eye contact. That's not your style. So talk about that. Like, how's that? Like, it's one thing when they bring you in because they want that. But then, you know, sometimes people don't want what they want or what they ask for, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think for me, you can't reformulate a 200-year-old recipe, right? You have to protect the things that are sacred. But you also, so like seven simple ingredients, the bake, but what you have to modernize is the positioning. You have to change things from like being an accompaniment to a eating occasion. But when it comes to the team, I think there's a couple of things you have to change, right? Or look for. First, you have to look for the friction, right? Where is the friction? And I think the friction is really in a couple of different places, right? You have to look for the place where consumers have friction with your brand and the place where your team has friction. And it's never the same place, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to figure out how do you sort of figure out where is the point where there's a disconnect and fix that. And then you have to change the hearts and minds of your organization, right? They've usually been used to being told no, or one of the answers that I just can't stand is that's the way we've always done it, right? That doesn't work for me. I have a bias towards change. And what I mean by that is sometimes I'll change things even if they're working. And the reason for that is that you always learn something new, right? You find something that you weren't looking at. You find some other process, some system, some way of improvement. You can always go backwards, but you can't, you know, if you don't make those changes. And going back to people, in every organization, you've got a leadership team. Mm-hmm. But I think the most overlooked people are the culture carriers. And these are people who never show up on a deck. They never show up on an org chart. But what they are the hearts and minds of the organization, right? And when they walk out the door, half the building leaves with them or right behind them.
You're right.
And if you can share your vision and get their alignment, you win over the whole organization. So I think finding who those people are is so important, and talking to them and making them understand the value of what you're doing.
Yeah, that's you covered an awful lot right there. And it's very, once again, no, it's very on point. And again, because I was going to ask about culture. I mean, you know, again, from the surface, one would think you come in just to, I'm going to go in there and make these changes, and we're going to fix the EBITDA, and we're going to position this, and we're going to do this and all that, which sounds, it's very business oriented, and you are, which is great. But I know you, and culture is a big thing to you. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that it always starts with the people, right? And so if you've got a workforce that's not appreciated, if you have a workforce that, a team that just isn't communicating, you really can't make a lot of changes, right? I don't do anything, right? Like, I am not an expert in any field. It's really about getting to all the people who matter. And so, you know, one of the first things we do, we implement employee surveys. In most of these organizations, they've never had a voice. They've never had a chance to talk or share. We do it anonymously. We track it all. And then we take all of the results. And no matter how bad they are, we share them all out, right? Mm-hmm. We don't hide a single piece of it. And I think that's the way I work. I work with full transparency. Mm-hmm. I've often been called abrasive that way, or very direct. But yep. I think I think you move slow when you try and play games. I think people don't trust you when you try and hide things. And so just being direct and honest with your team, sharing your numbers, sharing the truth of what you're trying to build. And sometimes it does require changing out people. But again, doing it in a way that brings them dignity and gives them a chance to sort of move on in a way that's helpful to them. Because everyone's got a mortgage or everyone's got rent payments. Everyone's got to put food on the table. And so treating people as humans is still the most important thing in the whole every day.
That's great. So I'm going to go again, maybe not on a limb here, but so you said something very interesting to me, and I think you're spot on. The culture happens in all these, I'll say in the corners and the folks, they're maybe not, like you said, they're not the people whose pictures on the deck. So you have that culture. So you're learning from them, and it's super important because you know you need to grow that in order to do everything you're trying to do. Then you have your leadership team, and then you have, I'll say maybe the board or your ownership team. So you've got that sort of three fiefdoms there. So I don't say underlings, but some of these culture carriers, some of these folks that are in the company, you're listening to them. There's probably things at the leadership level that you got to change. And then there's things at maybe the ownership level or the board level that, you know, well, we've always done it this way, or, hey, it's worked for this many years, or this is how we do it. How do you navigate all of that?
I think it starts with truth and transparency, right? Mm-hmm. And so I am probably the most conflict comfortable executive or person I've met. I'm perfectly fine talking to people about the hard things, about sharing what is bad news, what is working, what isn't. And I think most people can handle bad news. I truly believe that. What they can't handle are surprises. So when you're working with an ownership group or a private equity firm, I always have a rule that the second we get bad news, I'm texting, I'm calling, I'm not waiting a month or a quarter to share. Mm-hmm. I will often hold back on the positive news because I believe positive news flows through your P&L.
Yeah.
But when it comes to sharing bad news, we do it directly. And I think a lot of times leaders feel like they have to protect their team and you have to carry all of the weight. Mm-hmm. And I did that earlier in my career. You're actually not protecting them at all. In fact, you're hurting the whole organization. Because they're the ones who can solve the problems.
Right.
And so when I find that we have an issue or an opportunity or a challenge, we put it out there. Like we put it out there in all communications. We share it. And usually someone else way closer, way smarter, that spends all their time thinking about these things or doing these things has the solution already. So let's just find a way to surface it up. I've got an interesting management technique that in order to make sure that the best idea wins. And I think a lot of times as an executive, you think that you've got the best idea or you have your vision and it might not align, or you have your plan. It doesn't align with what other people see. And so when someone brings you an idea, you say, you poo-poo it. You say, no, we're going to go in this direction. But what I have the team do is I say, look, if you can convince three other people that you're right and you're and they agree with you, you can do a formal ambush. And you can ambush your supervisor. You can ambush me. And you can say, this is a formal ambush. The four of us, marketing, ops, sales, finance, all believe that this is the right course of action. And you're not seeing it. And 9 times out of 10, they're right.
Yeah.
And I think you just have to know that, like, you have to be open to that, and you have to be flexible. Otherwise nothing really changes.
I think, you know, similarly, I guess in my business now, I did not jump around. I've been at the same company that I founded, but my thing, and this was like literally the week I started the company. I was 27 years old, and a bunch of my buddies actually got back there was newspapers then, right? There was an article in the newspaper about this new agency. And my quote, they thought was kind of they thought I was a fool. Right? So my buddies got the newspaper article and they framed them. Two of my friends framed them and mailed them to me, right? And because they thought I was a kind of an idiot. Maybe I was. I said, my goal in business is simple. My business model is clean. My goal is to be the dumbest person in the company. And so my friends thought that they misquoted me or whatever else. No, that's my philosophy. Because when I started, you know, I had to kind of wear all the hats. And then what I would do is I'd get somebody who's better at me at whatever hat that was, and kept doing it over and over and over and over and over and over. And finally, it's amazing how it's how it's worked. I mean, you know, you can have, if your ego is such that, you know everything and you're the smartest in the room, you hire a company of like midgets, of like little people. You don't get giants. So if you have people that are better than you, you have a company of giants, and then they can do things. And it's, and that's, I think that's in a weird way. Well, not a weird way. That's been some of the success I've had, because we were able to create companies and people can run them and do things with them that they don't need me. Because candidly, they don't need me. As simple as that, actually.
I 100% agree with that. I have a saying that if I can do your job better than you, you shouldn't work for me. And the bar is low. Like I shouldn't be able to do anything, and I've made the mistake. I thought we could move our forklifts faster. I got in a forklift. Yep. I drove it through a wall. Like I have made every mistake. But the folks in my organization can all do their jobs at a much higher, a much superior level than I ever could.
Yeah, the other thing too, it's funny because you bring up so many important points. It's okay to make a mistake, and it's okay to let people know I made a mistake, because that it's true. And like, I think that makes things more accessible for everybody. I mean, I made lots of mistakes, and I oftentimes can track back and say, I know why I made this decision. I know how I made this mistake. All those answers I got made sense at the time, and it didn't work out. So, and that's all you can do, right? You take the best information you have and you run with it, whether it's a new way of doing the forklifts or a new process or a new whatever. I mean, you just do it. And if you fail, it's like, hey, on me,
I agree. And I think you should never discipline someone over a mistake.
No.
But no. I for sure will discipline people over hiding the mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like,
no doubt.
Make the mistake, own it. Let's roll up our sleeves together. Let's fix it. We won't beat a dead horse. We'll not come back to it. Everyone learn from it. We put in processes where it doesn't happen again. We move on.
Yeah. My line was simply we never punish sins of proactivity. We will punish sins of inactivity. Hiding, slowing. Yeah. That was always my thing. I think that's because we want to have a fast company. We want to be smart. We want to try things. We're very entrepreneurial, the whole place. And I celebrate that. And look, you're going to make mistakes. It's all that comes with the turf. And it's like baseball, you fail seven times and you're in the Hall of Fame. So, you just got to play the numbers, right? So okay, I'm going to jump into branding here a little bit. And you said something very interesting, because again, knowing you and what you do and how you come into a company, it's similar, I'll say, to what I do, because you come into a company and again, the ownership, the board may say, we want this and we want this change and we want to get to this EBITDA, or we want to have our company get this size, or whatever the goals are. They're going to say they want all those things, and they haven't been able to do it before. They're hiring you to do it. Right. Well, in our case, people say, hey, we have this brand and we want to increase sales, or we want to become distributed more nationally, or we want to grow. But then it's like when it comes to the change part, right? We have to do, the ideas have to be kind of breakthrough. They have to be a little edgy because people aren't paying attention. So, and then they get nervous. Oh, we can't say that. Or, oh, we can't do it that way. I'm sure you probably hear some things like, no, we can't do it that way. Or we can't, we can't affect that. How do you handle that? Because you get hired. It's like, okay, great. High fives. Great. Let's roll. And all of a sudden, the speed bumps come.
So I'm very much goal oriented. And so the first thing we do is we come up with the corporate goals, OKRs, for the whole organization. And we get buy-in from my entire team. We get buy-in from the board. So they can't be changing goals, priorities, KPIs, right? And we hold them for a year, right? And I always find that people aren't good at doing 30 things. An organization is not good at doing 30 things. So I like to keep them three or four things. Every year, we can do three or four things great, we move the needle. And so first is to figure out what those things are, get alignment, and then we roll those down to each department and down to each person. And so that ladder is pretty clear. So then even if I go, hey, I've got this crazy new idea, we should do this, someone will say, Amit, which one of my OKRs is this? Oh, dang. Like none of those.
Right.
Which one do you want me to delete and replace? Nope. Stay the course, right? Yep. Stay the course. And I think it's the ability to do that. And then the other thing to make that change happen is, I think a lot of times people set long-term goals, right? But they don't bridge it back to monthly or weekly, definitely. I have found that most people, when you have a deadline, you work on it 2 or 3 days before the deadline, right? Like, I think that's just human nature. So what I do is we take all of the goals and we back them up to weekly goals. And we hold a weekly call with everybody who's OKRs on the board. And we say, what's the progress from last week? Did you hit the goal? And these are mini sprints, but they keep the ball moving every week. And also, you don't get jammed up. Oh, there's a constraint. Something's happened. Oh, this customer's not working with us. This vendor's not working with us. We don't find out 3 months later. We find out that week. And then we get their partner. Let's get the ops team. Oh, let's get the sales team. Let's get the finance team. Solve this problem between this week and next week so we can keep moving. So I think one of the things is we just keep a very fast pace. And that's in order to implement the changes that we've all aligned on.
I love it. If you measure it, it'll improve. And candidly, if you don't measure it for a year, well, hell, you're not going to, it's a waste of time. And I think everyone read the book Good to Great. So everyone's like, what's the BHAG? So in 10 years, we're going to be, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then they're going to wait, to your point, and then it'll be like 2 weeks before the 10 years is up. And it's like, well, we didn't get there. How do we get there in 2 weeks? And you can't do it. You got to do it week one, week two, week three, week four. I think that's, again, really, really, really smart advice. So when you come into an established brand, that's what you in this case, in this most recent, this is what you've done. How do you figure out what needs to change and what maybe should stay the same? Like, what's the shortcut there?
I think what needs to change first and foremost is attitude, right? It's can we get people to be intellectually curious? Can we get people to have a can-do attitude? Can we get folks to understand the vision and the plan and ensure that we have what I say aces in their places, right? Do we have the right folks to do that? And sometimes, and most of the time, we actually have the right people. They're just not in the right seats, right? So sometimes you got to move some people up. Sometimes you got to move some people down. Sometimes you have to move people across departments. But for me, it's like, again, it goes back to what I say. It comes back to the people. If you have the right people, you don't actually need to micromanage them. You just need to set the goals. I'm actually not a fan of one-on-ones because I think it takes away time. If anyone on my team needs me, every single person on my team has my cell phone. Every single person knows they can get me at any time. If they need to meet, let's meet. Otherwise, go run the playbook, go run your role, go hard, go fast.
Got it. I love it. I love it. So what's harder getting, and because you've done both of these situations, what's harder, getting consumers to notice a new brand? Right? There's new, fresh, new, exciting, new, or getting them to reconsider an established one?
Reconsidering, and it isn't even close. Indifferent familiarity is the hardest disease in CPG to cure. With an emerging brand, you're fighting for awareness, no doubt. But that's a marketing tax. It's expensive, but you have to pay it. With an established brand, you have to change perception. You have to change habits, and you have to do it at the same time. And consumers already think they know you. You've already failed them once, and nobody wants to be wrong about you twice.
It's great, great, great point. So, okay, Kate, food companies love innovation, but not every new product needs to exist. How do you tell the difference between meaningful innovation and innovation for innovation's sake? I run into this a lot with different clients.
So here's the version that makes me very unpopular in marketing meetings. I've created more value killing SKUs than launching them.
Right. That's smart.
Everybody gets a launch party. Nobody throws a party for the SKU you've killed. And that that's what usually pays for the year. At Pop Chips, discontinued 75% of SKUs and all the prior 5 years worth of innovation. At Harvest, discoed half the SKUs. Both of those changes changed the trajectory of the business from a focus point, from a top line, and from a profitability.
Yeah. I mean, so in my case, you know, obviously we have Pavone Group, we have Quench, which is our food and beverage agency. We do a lot of legacy brands. We, you know, take brands that have been around for a long time, like Starkist and Sunmade, and, you know, and reintroduce them, if you will, make them relevant. I had in the company, in the portfolio, I had a company called Leap Innovation. Mm-hmm. And it was a great company. And there was a woman that was running it, was brilliant and great at innovation. And clients love innovation. At the time, we were doing all of the innovation for the Hershey company. And we were doing all the innovation for Campbell's. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Adweek had written, you know, Campbell's has, this is true, the Campbell's has more new products and innovation in their pipeline than in the history, right? And that was us doing it. Brilliant work. And then I'd be on the advertising side. And I'd be like, you know, innovation is the enemy of brand, because we're out there doing, to my clients, and to the, they're out there doing all these new things, and there's time, there's effort, there's attention, and it's all over here. It's like, wait a second, what about that? What about the main product? What about this? What about the main market? And you're absolutely right on that. And so it got to the point that it really was a bit of a conflict, even though it lived within many companies in the same department, you know, marketing, innovation, all right there. So it was a really interesting conundrum, you know? And so I appreciate your take on that, because I subscribe to what you're saying. I mean, look, you need to have innovation, especially if you're an older brand, you know what I mean? Like with the Starkist guys, flavors. We just got we traded tuna like potato chips. I mean, why not have a barbecue? Why not have a honey barbecue? Why not have a sriracha? Why not have a, and that was brilliant, right? Yeah. But we stayed with the brand. We weren't trying to create two totally new companies, new areas.
I think meaningful innovation unlocks a new consumption occasion.
Right. Right.
Everything else just steals from your core velocity.
Well done. Yep. That's well said. Well said. So, okay. When you're trying to grow a brand, how do you know whether the answer is better marketing, better distribution, better product, or something deeper?
I think it's simple math, really, on trial versus repeat. Marketing gets you the first purchase. Product mm-hmm. quality gets you the third. So mm-hmm. if the repeat rate is high, but volume is flat, you have a distribution or awareness problem that marketing can solve, right? Mm-hmm. If trial is high and repeat is zero,
product.
No amount of glossy marketing will save
right?
You can't market your way out of product that doesn't deliver.
Yep. Yeah, we can only sell, I mean, advertising can only sell a bad product once.
Yep, correct. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the biggest trend that you're paying attention to in your industry right now?
I think everyone's talking about it. It's GLP-1s. But mm-hmm. I don't think it's for the reason that most people give. I think the era of selling air is over. When consumers mm-hmm. eat less, every bite has to earn its place on the plate. And it's fundamentally changing the dynamics across the shelf. People aren't eating just less. They're eating differently, right? It's not just mm-hmm. low calories anymore. It's high density efficiency. Every bite has to deliver something. You have to deliver protein. You have to deliver fiber, something with functional value. And in the past, a lot of brands were built on light, airy filler. And I think they're going to struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, we're big trends guys, and we do the trends every year. And the GLP-1, I mean, even though it's not a food trend, it kind of is. It's a massive trend, you know, whether it's size of products, like smaller cans, if you will, or smaller packaging, whether it's protein laden, whatever. I mean, add protein to the water, to the chip, to the whatever you can add protein to. Yeah. So it really is affecting across the board. It's pretty interesting. So you spend a lot of time in better for you food. How has the consumer definition of healthy changed over the years?
It's completely inverted, and it's happened faster than I think the industry has adjusted. You know, growing up, healthy used to mean taking bad things out. Today, mm-hmm. it means putting good things in, right? It used to be subtraction. Take out the fat, take out the carbs, take out the sodium, take out the calories, take out the sugar. But today it's addition, right? As I mentioned, it's putting in fiber for gut health. It's putting in protein for satiety. Like it's guilt mitigation. So better for you isn't diet anymore. It's permission.
Mm-hmm. I like that, guilt mitigation. I like that a lot. I can use that. So consumers are still willing to sacrifice taste. Are they willing to sacrifice taste for health? Or is that basically over? I mean, is the days of bad protein bars over?
I don't actually think they ever were willing to sacrifice taste for health benefits. They just said they were on a survey in January. I think the Better For You graveyard is full of products that won focus groups and lost the second purchase, right? Health buys you trial, taste buys you the other 11.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. You only sell a bad product once. So what do emerging food brands misunderstand most about today's consumer?
This is one that I put on the wall. Nobody loves your brand. Nobody loves a cracker. What people love is that the night that went fine, right? Our job isn't to be adored. It's to be the thing that didn't let you down when somebody had 11 minutes and a hungry kid, right? I think founders spend years building a brand people are supposed to feel something about. The actual job is just being reliable, you know, 640 on a weeknight.
That's great. We're working with a client, a global client, and we produced a video for his global sales meeting. And it's funny because, you know, it's a great product. It's in the protein category. And his whole thing is we're selling memories. Like his whole thing is like it's an emotional connection. Food's an emotional connection. And we want to sell that memory. That memory can be your son's birthday party tonight, the meal you guys had. It's all a part. They're just sort of like a along for the ride, but they're there to help make the memory and hopefully bring convenience so that you can enjoy that birthday party more. And I found that to be, and the CEO is an extremely passionate guy, and it was really, really compelling. And you know, because I mean, again, products are phenomenal, and you could sit there and talk about brand attributes and things all day long. But to your point, you know, it's like, what does the consumer really want? Yeah, they want it to taste good. Yeah, they want a healthy, good product. But it really is about the convenience, the memory, the you know, be a part of my life. Don't manipulate it.
Yeah, don't mess it up.
They're even better. Don't mess it up. So now that you're running a cracker company that dates back to 1828, that's a big change because you've done all these brands that were, you know, relatively new, built around innovation. You know, what attracted you to Westminster Cracker Company? I mean, again, and you can talk about like some of your past, you know, entrepreneurial ventures. I mean, you know, so you're out there cutting edge thinking, you know, new. And then here you go to a very, you know, a company that's been around for a long time with a history.
Yeah. Well, you know, Arctic Zero was the first ice cream company to put protein in ice cream, right? We were the first.
We were ahead of the curve, man.
Yeah, we were ahead of the curve. Pop Chips was the first better for you potato chip brand, right? And so being part of emerging brands, we've spent millions trying to buy authenticity, right? But a 200-year-old brand already owns it, right?
Yep, that's right.
And so there's just that heritage and the opportunity to – what attracted me to Westminster was the opportunity to never – I didn't need to fix the foundation, right? It was – it's got seven simple ingredients. We make it the same way. It's got a 16-hour proofing process. The facility is in rural Vermont. We've been making it there a long time. But the opportunity was to take this pristine, authentic asset that people already trusted and apply a modern growth strategy, like new snacking occasions, expanded retail distribution. It was to take this product that everyone's already eating, right? If you been to Chick-fil-A, if you've been to Olive Garden, if you've been to Illegal Seafood, if you've been to Potbelly, if you've been to Roots Chris, if you've been to Capital Grill, you're already eating our products. You already love the products. How do we actually get you to eat them on different occasions?
Repeat. You know, you nailed it too on the whole like the quality and the simplicity of the of how you can have an authentic story. Because I'll say this, as an agency, we're hired a lot of times to basically create a story. There's nothing there. It's a company, they now make this and they want to sell it, and they need us to create a brand, a story, you know, a personality around the brand. And that's fine. I mean, we do that. That's something we do. But man, when you find a company that's built and been around for a long time, sometimes all you need is just tell the story. Just tell it a little better. Case in point, last week I presented to a company called Kadoya. Kadoya is sesame oil from Japan. It is, and I'm not selling here, it is the best. The way they make it, they've been making it the same way for, you know, hundreds of years. It's a very flavor-forward sesame oil. And so I'm one with literally 10 Japanese people, the owners of the brand and other marketers. And, you know, I'm trying to explain to them, like we have to usually tell a story in America. Like we have to make up a story. You guys have a story. Like you're better. You're pure. Your quality is better. Your taste is better. Just getting that out there. Now you have to do it in a creative way because people get bored with brand attributes, but we will find a really unique way to tell a story. But that's all we need to do. That's why people will buy you. Right. I mean, cause it's already, it's inherited. It's an eight in the product.
Of course. Yeah. And most brands would pay a fortune to have that history.
Oh yeah, that's right. So, but oftentimes, and maybe in your case, the company, maybe not, I don't say they get bored with it, but they take it for granted. They realize that they forget that they're, oh, we're this old, who cares about an old company? Well, you know, people care about that stuff now. I mean, it's important, right?
I agree, especially when that heritage is authentic and it also has just superior products, right? Like consumers are burnt out on the over-engineered, hyper-processed foods, right? You've got the sesame oil with so much heritage, and you know, it's like it was clean label before clean label was a thing.
That's right. That's right.
And so, you know, if you can tell that story correctly, it will absolutely resonate.
And ironically, we have to help them in the U.S. to put the clean label information on it. They've been clean forever. But now we have to like call it out with like little icons because, you know, because consumers look for that. So we almost had like, they almost didn't understand that. Like, why do we have to, we've always been this way.
It's
like,
no. Story, right?
Yeah. America.
That's what you do, right? That's what you do better than anybody.
Yeah. So it's kind of funny though, but like, you know, you hit on something too with like, with these old brands that we do have nostalgia, you know, and I try to hit them with that and explain that to them. I mean, you have that opportunity as well. That's sort of a consumer trend right now. The nostalgia thing, people, the younger consumers are starting to kind of dig back in. So you can take advantage of that stuff as well.
No, I agree. I think the thing that gets forgotten is nostalgia gets you that trial, but it's really the consistency that keeps the consumer coming back, right? So you just have to keep delivering.
So I'm going to jump ahead here into some other parts of the business. You've worked closely with private equity throughout your career. What does private equity get right about the food business, and what do they get wrong?
Sure. I think every fund brings financial discipline. They bring cash flow rigor. They bring operational focus. That part's given. It's table stakes. What separates them is when they show up with relationships or just a spreadsheet. I'll give you a great example. When I ran PopChips with BMG, was the private equity firm. They came to customer meetings with me. They used relationships to open doors with customers I couldn't get on my own. Mm-hmm. And then they also helped me hire the right team. They brought in folks who had worked with them before who they knew. And it just made such a huge difference. And then they let us run, right? It's the same thing as I said earlier about building a team. They hired the right team. They put all the pieces together. They gave us the resources. And sometimes the resources were those connections. And then we got out of the way, right?
Awesome.
Where it's bad or wrong is it's just they run the company off of a spreadsheet where, you know, the oven always works or the popcorn machine always continues to pop, right? You see them use a spreadsheet that will fund marketing and starve out the plant. You think they can grow without investing in people or processes or systems. And really, you can't cut your way to a great product, right? No one's ever been able to do that. You actually have to invest in the things that matter.
That's great. That's great. And again, the PE conversation, I mean, there's so many horror stories and then so many success stories, right? And it's like, I think again, I could talk to you for hours on this stuff because I really do admire your, very pragmatic, very clean read on all of these things. I mean that sincerely. I just, I really, really, in fact, I'm talking to private equity later on today about a different industry. And, you know, so I'm listening. I'm like, yeah, that's really good. I remember that, you know, the connections and stuff. Cause you're right. You expect the acumen. You expect the financial background and all that, you know. And you know, yeah, we can all talk about cutting costs, right? But let's face it, you don't cut your way to success. It's about everything else around it. And I think it's really, really well said.
I'll even tell you another story. Like working for LaSalle, they completely let me run the team, and there was someone I wanted to hire, wasn't in the budget, but they said, go ahead, it's your team, you build, you hire. This person, 100x her salary in year one in terms of revenue, 100x. And they were like, you were right. You made the right call. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the fact that they were humble enough and also willing to let me run the team my way, I absolutely appreciate that. And yeah, it delivered, great. Right? And it delivered.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you don't always hear that when it comes to the PE deals and stuff like that. So after all these years in food and beverage, you know, if a founder came to you tomorrow with a great product and wanted a piece of advice about building a lasting company, what would you tell them? What would your advice be?
You know, I started my career in private equity. So mm-hmm. this connects to what you just asked me, but from the other side of the table, like the day you start fundraising, you are not in the CPG business anymore. You're in the fundraising business. Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, you're only as good as your next raise, right? Your next fundraise. Mm-hmm. Everything starts to bend around it, right? Your calendar, your metrics, the decisions you make in the fourth quarter of what you'll ship or what you'll launch, and how it'll look in a deck. So I think most people just take the highest dollar amount or they take the highest valuation, but I think it is so important to choose your partners for how they'll behave when things go badly, because things always go badly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
oh, yeah.
You just, it's how do you handle them? How do you choose your partners? And look, we've all made the mistake. We've all picked poor partners in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think really figuring out what that lens is to make sure that you have the right ones will change the trajectory of your relationship and the time you spend managing the business versus managing your investors.
Yeah. And to your point though, the raises and becoming a fundraiser takes away from your day job, which is making the product, pushing the product, marketing the product, selling the product, and everything that got you to that, probably where your passion was, right? That's probably where people's passion started, was with their product. So again, it's going to certainly take.
Nobody loves fundraising. I'd say like, no, at least if you got into the CPG business because you had an idea or there was an opportunity gap, you want to be focused on selling that and building that.
Absolutely.
And innovating and growing that. Not, hey, I need to go shake hands and, you know, kiss babies to try and get more dollars to do what I want to do. And you're right. It's a full-time job. Like oftentimes you have two founders and one founder's job is like strictly to fundraise and the other founder's job is to operate the company, because it's more than one person can usually handle.
Yeah, there's no question. That's wonderful advice. So my last question, I ask this of everybody, right? And since you're not, well, you can't say crackers. Okay, I'll just throw that out there. So last question, if you have one food, one final meal, what would you eat and why? It can be from a restaurant, it can be something that you make, it can be something from your family, it could be anything. What would your one final meal be and why?
Final meal, a paper plate of greasy $2 street tacos, a glass of top shelf tequila on the rocks with, don't judge me on this, exactly three Luxardo cherries dropped in.
Oh, nice. Wow.
First is a garnish. The second's a mistake. But the third, it's a recipe.
There you go. All right. I love it. I have lots of Luxardos in my Manhattans and my bourbons, but I've never had them in tequila. I'm going to learn something. I mean, I learned more than one thing today, but that's one I'm certainly going to take away.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get together.
All right, man.
And have some tequila with cherries.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, I could talk to you for hours. I really do appreciate being here and just tons of great insight. And thank you. And congratulations again on all the success. Oh. It's one thing some people get lucky enough to have success in one place. You've had success pretty much everywhere you go. And I think that's amazing.
Well, thanks, Michael. It's fun to share the story. And, you know, I've made more than my fair share of mistakes and, but I've always been able to surround myself with really amazing people and team members and mentors that have helped along the way.
It's awesome. Well, and you've been helping a lot of people yourself, and you deserve a lot of credit for that too. So congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, pal. Thanks.